der Seehofer einen Verstand verloren? Kann das sein? Der redet doch nur noch Quatsch.
Verloren?
Ja, der hat früher so einen ganz...
Hat er
ganz
ihn?
Ja, der hat früher so einen vergleichsweise gefassten Eindruck gemacht immer. Und irgendwie in den letzten Monaten sabbelt der nur noch Mist. Das ist total irre. Da muss doch mal ein Arzt, kann da nicht mal ein Psychiater hin? Und mal gucken, ich kann ihm auch zeigen, wo der wohnt.
Das kann man ja auch über Twitter organisieren.
Ich weiß, wo Horst Seehofer wohnt.
Impressive.
Ha. So. Dafür ist das gedacht. Jetzt habe ich es verstanden.
Genau.
Horst Seehofer, super.
Komfort Nummer 242, 27C3. Hallo und herzlich willkommen zum 242. Komfort. Der ganz überraschend jetzt dann doch noch nicht der Jahresrückblick ist. Da hatte ich auch nicht mit gerechnet, gebe ich ja zu. Sondern sich mit zwei Vorträgen vom 27. Chaos Communication Kongress befasst. Der stattfindet vom 27. bis 30. Dezember. Die zwei Vorträge, die ich mir da geschnappt habe, sind beide am 27. gewesen, weil macht ja sonst irgendwie nur begrenzt Sinn, wenn ich erst am 30. anfange, einen Podcast zu backen. Und nachdem ich ja nun nicht in Berlin war, wie in den letzten Jahren, kann ich da also auch nicht mit Live-Aufnahmen direkt vor Ort dienen. Hab aber dafür es geschafft, mir sind in die Finger gefallen zwei Stream-Dumps, weil die offiziellen Aufzeichnungen auch noch ein bisschen auf sich warten lassen. Und die habe ich dann noch so ein bisschen aufgehübscht. Und vor allen Dingen mir eben die zwei interessantesten Vorträge rausgesucht. Ich hoffe doch, es gefällt. Und was ihr euch jetzt anhören könnt, wenn ihr hier einfach weiterhört, das ist dann Teil 1, die Keynote. Und zwar ist das auf Englisch. Also wer kein Englisch kann, braucht sich hier gar nicht weiter anhören. Rob Gongkrieb, wie immer man den Namen richtig ausspricht. Ich versuch's gar nicht erst. Ein Holländer, der sich auch schon intensiver seit Jahrzehnten in der Hacker-Szene rumtreibt. Und der hat halt die Keynote dieses Jahr halten dürfen. Da ist die Aufnahme, die ich mir da rausgeholt habe, 28 Minuten 33 lang. Kriegt ihr jetzt dann einfach mal auf die Ohren. Viel Spaß damit. The story of a civilization destroying its capability to fix itself by making everybody artificially happy. I know this is not our field per se, but I feel this is at least as big a story as many of the issues that this community is working on. I think in the future we'll see a scientific field called pharmacological political science or something like that. And I have a feeling that people of the future cannot really understand our time without that field. One of the positive suggestions we did offer in We Lost the War was to focus on battles that could be won. If I had listened to all of these people around me, I would have been taking Prozac or Zoloft in 2005. My life would have been different and possibly much happier, especially in the short term, but a lot of things that happened to me since would not have happened because they involved me being angry and attempting to do something about it. I'll quickly go into this electronic voting thing. Thank you. My own city, Amsterdam, opted to buy electronic voting machines for the elections of 2006. And I knew there was no possibility to verify the election outcome and that one had to essentially trust proprietary and secret software to have any trust at all. I spent the next 2.5 years investigating, campaigning, lobbying, lawyering. Around the same time, Ulrich Wiesner and his father Joachim were fighting voting machines, the same voting machines made by the same company here in Germany. I won't get into all of the details because that story has been told at previous congresses, but the short version is that the ensuing fight involved large parts of this community and that today these machines are not legal for use in elections in either country. Now, in Germany, that outcome is cemented securely in place by a constitutional court ruling that gives citizens the right to see with their own eyes whether election results
come from something real or whether they come out of software somehow. In the Netherlands, we'll have to fight this battle over and over again, all the time, debating complex issues with small town mayors and municipal employees, because we have no constitution. I won't go into every detail of what happened to me since 2005, but I did have a really crazy past year. Maybe not quite as crazy as some of my friends, but still. For one, I probably traveled more in the last year year and a half than I did in the 10 years before that. It started in October 2009 when Julian Assange and myself were keynote speakers at Hack in the Box in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur. We subsequently spent a month in the sun traveling Malaysia, Thailand, Cambodia. We got to know each other pretty well. A month or two after, previous Congress, Geeks was still a relatively obscure, geeky, but gutsy journalism project. Julian and Daniel got a standing ovation while they stood on this stage speaking about WikiLeaks and about new opportunities for protecting freedom of the press in Iceland. 3 weeks later, I was in Reykjavik with them and others to help write a proposal for IMI, the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative. Then I was home for a week, and then I left for India to speak on voting machines. All of India has been voting on blackbox-style voting machines for the past decade, so that's a billion people. And it's beginning to dawn on some of these people that there's a problem with transparency. I was there with Alex Haldeman, an e-voting-related professor from the University of Michigan, and Till Jaeger, the German lawyer who won the case against voting machines here in Germany before the Constitutional Court. Together, we met with politicians and we spoke at conferences, but probably the most important thing that happened was for Alex and myself to study an actual Indian voting machine together with our Indian colleague, Hari Prasad. Then I was home for 3 weeks again and I left for Iceland, this time to help out on releasing a video that's now famous, the Iraqi helicopter video that was released by WikiLeaks. I didn't plan for that. I read the WikiLeaks Twitter feed, concluded that Julian needed some help, and I flew out a few hours later. I stayed for 2 very hectic weeks, helping produce the video, and then traveled with Julian to a press conference in Washington. After that, I had to get back to writing the study on the Indian voting machines, which, hardly surprising, were just as easy to manipulate as any other black box voting system ever studied. We proved yet again that anyone with access to the machines could easily change the outcome of the election. Then later in the year, I went to Brazil to look at e-voting there. Now, their systems are even more dangerous than anyone else's. It's black box voting machines, but they get the ID card numbers of the voters entered into them. And newer versions even have fingerprint scanners. But of course, the software would never lie about the results of elections or store the vote and the voter in the same database. And since it prints out hashes of all the program files on the sort of MS-DOS-like box, it could never be manipulated. Brazil has perfectly secure electronic voting machines until we get our hands on them. After Brazil, I was home for a week again and then traveled to India for 2 weeks. This time, we were there to help solve the problem instead of merely pointing it out. Alex Haldeman and myself were invited to a conference on voting, but as we arrived, we were detained for a night and half a day at the airport because we had apparently, quote, violated the terms of our visa the last time we had traveled to India. India's main intelligence agency had somehow investigated us as part of an international conspiracy to destabilize the state of India. We were eventually released after lots of phone calls and lots of ministries were involved. The Home Minister was woken up. All sorts of things happened. And we had to promise that we would not attend this conference, which was a relatively sort of obscure academic conference. From a PR standpoint, that whole thing didn't really work. Because we were now regular tourists, except CNN was waiting for us at the exit of the airport. But meanwhile, India still has a very serious problem that needs fixing urgently. India is the type of country that could easily slip into serious violence if there's too much doubt in election outcomes. So this is definitely a story that's to be continued.
And there's a funny side note. Just 2 weeks ago, India and Brazil signed an agreement, a sort of a very bland agreement that has very few details, but they involve working together on unspecified matters involving election organization. WikiLeaks is a bigger issue that deserves a little bit more talking about. I helped WikiLeaks release the video. After that, I needed to get back to my e-voting-related work, but I could have stuck around helping WikiLeaks do all these other things that they ended up doing. They could probably have used me releasing all these other things. That did not happen. And I guess I could make up all sorts of stories about how I disagreed with people or with decisions. But the truth is that in the period that I helped out, the possible ramifications of WikiLeaks managed to scare the bejesus out of me. Courage is contagious, they say. Well, my ass. I wish Julian and his people well, but I can't live a life out of a backpack on the run, not to mention the fact that Julian has better and does much better on bites. So what are we to make of WikiLeaks? It's clear that recent events will impact the world and our corner of it for some time to come. But it's really early to tell how, as things are still going on. WikiLeaks could well come out victorious in a new generational conflict, mentioned in the same line with the suffragettes and the Vietnam protesters. But as it stands today, my friend Julian is potentially facing prison time or even assassination for what essentially amounts to practicing journalism. At the same time, many people friendly to the ideas behind WikiLeaks are beginning to wonder what has been unleashed. Some of my friends have said Julian has angered the gods. Bruce Sterling recently accused him of weeing all over the third rail. And a good friend of mine said that Julian was committing suicide by cop, even. Whatever we make of it, present anger and fear at governments over WikiLeaks will probably up the pressure to curb internet freedoms. Whether connected to WikiLeaks or not, CryptoWars 2.0 has recently been announced. There's a new American proposal to make all providers of any kind of online service provide the authorities with clear text of everything that happens. As a result of WikiLeaks, authorities the world over will probably at least try even harder to clamp down on internet freedom. So organizations resisting this will have to work harder also. But regarding WikiLeaks, we also need to calm down a bit. There's obviously some very big things going on here, and we need to keep watching them intently. But just because we like or share some of the principles at stake here doesn't mean our community is all of a sudden drawn into this all-out war with a ridiculously well-armed superpower or anybody else. Whatever our role is, it's certainly not to deny freedom of speech to people or organizations who don't like freedom of speech. This whole anonymous thing is so getting on my nerves. People ask me, anonymous, that's like the hacker community striking back, right? And then I have to explain that unlike anonymous, people in this community would probably not issue press releases with our real names in the PDF metadata. And that if this community were to get involved, the targets would probably be offline a little more often. This is a mental maturity issue. Our community has generally succeeded in giving black belts in computer security karate only to people that have proven a certain level of mental maturity. Yes, some of us could probably do some real damage to PayPal or to MasterCard, but then we also understand that no good comes from that. In the unlikely event, by the way, that anybody here has not reached this level of maturity, please do not connect your machine to the network. Talk to a lot of other people. Get some additional perspectives, because it's the way to go. On the positive side, some of the things we care about that are dear to our hearts are going to get a lot of attention, and this attention can be used for good if we keep our wits about us. And finally, on the WikiLeaks issue, I now have cell phone coverage in my office in the basement, which I didn't have before. Yay. Now let's take a wider look at today. As we enter uncharted terrain, we are the first generation in a long time to see our leaders in a state of more or less complete helplessness. Most of today's politicians realize that nobody in their ministry or any of their expensive consultants can tell them what the fuck's going on anymore. They have a steering wheel in their hands, but they don't really know what it's connected to, if anything. Meanwhile, the brakes are obviously out, and the windy road at the bottom of the hill is approaching rapidly. Politics is becoming more and more the act of looking at least slightly relaxed while silently praying that the accident will happen sometime after your term is up. Now, that's not completely fair. The fact that politicians are generally helpless in terms of public policy doesn't mean that to say that I think they're stupid. They do have a vague sense of what might be coming, and they're acting accordingly. To judge their efficiency, take a good look at the remaining public funds and the remaining public infrastructure and see who owns it in 5 years' time. Our leaders are reassuring us that this ship will certainly survive the coming storm. Oh, yeah, no problem. But on closer inspection, they're either quietly pocketing the silverware or discreetly making their way to the lifeboats. Even politicians that are the exception, the ones that get it, that want to help get us out of this mess, are increasingly indistinguishable from ones that just pretend. We'll have to learn to navigate a world in which every imaginable aspect of being genuine or sincere has 10,000 spin doctors working on how to transplant that precise thing to the fake turds that run things. Now, this all sounds really smug, like we, the hackers, the geeks, somehow have all the answers. We do not. But we do have some important parts. For one, we understand the extent to which complexity can be our enemy. We've all written stuff that got out of control. We've optimized our privatized world of today to get that last 2% of profitability. And we're already in a situation where everything we need comes just in time from China, assuming that we'll need exactly the same things overall as we needed a year ago. Everything is interconnected, and if one thing fails, the whole system goes down. Winter chaos that's gone out recently is just another sign of slack that's in our current society. We also look at different perspectives. In that context, we can all see that our narrative is gaining importance. At the same time, Apple, Google, Facebook, and the more geographically challenged traditional governments will try to make all of humanity enter their remaining secrets. They'll try to make attribution of every bit on the internet a part of the switch to IPv6 at the latest. They'll further lock us out of our own hardware, and they'll eventually attempt to kill privacy and anonymity altogether. We still have to tell most people out there that privacy is not in fact brought about by some magic combination of the intentionally confusing privacy radio button page on Facebook. It does come from, among other things, code from some of us have written and code that some of us still need to write. We need many things by yesterday, and we need to properly security audit the tools we build, even if that means we can't put in new features just as quickly. Now we'll look at the future. The future is always hardest to predict. I stand by our basic story of we lost the war. It's going to be a mess. I've just calmed down a lot when I decided for myself that this is not necessarily bad news, all of it. Let's face it, the current situation wasn't sustainable anyway. And people, both in rich and in poor countries, are not very happy now. Some may be rich, but we're not happy. Remember the massive loads of antidepressants we're taking to keep us going. The decline of the Roman Empire was probably a very interesting period to live in, and for most inhabitants, life just went on, with or without Rome. Okay, so the world is going to be a mess for a little bit. You may be asking yourself, what do I do with this knowledge? First of all, John Stewart had it nailed when he said recently at this event he organized, we live in difficult times, we do not live in end times. The future is not about finding solitude on a farm on a hill, guns, ammunition, but it is about having working trust relationships with the most varied group of people you can find. It's about imagining beyond today and picking up a wide range of skills if you can. It's positioning yourself such that you have flexibility. Even if everything stays the same, there's not much risk in any of this. If, on the other hand, some of the structures around us indeed implode over the next decade or two, we as a community will become no less important. Again, the world is not going to end. I promise there will be no zombies and humanity will survive. A lot of structures will survive. It's just going to be quite messy for a little bit. Lots of people will freak out. For us, we won't freak out so much because the news sites will just look more like Fefe's blog and TV news will be more like the Fnord Show. If the shit hits the fan, a lot of things are going to be decentralized, but still in a very networked world. Some of us will likely be reverse engineering and then re-engineering systems to get rid of some of the crazy complexity and dependencies. Improvising and doing more with less is something we are good at. Not to mention making things when we need them and repairing them instead of throwing them away. We come in peace. We're not called the Chaos Computer Club because we cause chaos. If anything, a lot of our collective work has actually prevented chaos by pointing out that maybe we should lay some decent virtual foundations before we build any more virtual skyscrapers. Val Holland explained the name to me many, many years ago. I don't even know exactly when. He felt that there was universal validity in a set of then rather new theories explaining very complex systems and complex behavior from random events and a very few simple rules. And it helped him explain a lot of how the world worked and how one could navigate a future that looked like Shockwave Rider. We may not cause chaos, but we do understand some small part of how chaos works. And we have been able to help others deal with it better. As this world becomes more chaotic and ad hoc, we can help. Now, this is the 27th Congress. I know 27 is not a nice round number where you have forced to look back like 23 or 42, but since... but since I'm 42 years old this year, I get to take a little helicopter view. I think we should all be proud of what's been created here. There's this video of the 24th Congress made by Kirin Schäublein and others, and I can show that video to a wide variety of people, and they generally first say, wow, and then they go, when's the next one? And that sums up the importance of Vent. It has drawn countless people into the community, many of whom did winter drivers. They were freebie currenters or Lisp programmers, but they are now as much a part of this community as anyone else. More than anything, this rather impressive gathering is what we use to show off how many sides there are to hacking. We may have been involved in some kind of hacking before we got here, but this Congress, more than any place else, is where it all comes together. This is where we decided that this is all so interesting and so important that we wanted to dedicate some part of our lives to it. Which brings me to how sad it makes me that we now need to click our tickets in the exact right few hours or otherwise they're gone. The people that set up the ticket system have done a great job making the best of a potentially very bad situation. But we... Yeah. But sooner or later, we have to face the fact that this magnificent building is becoming too small, or rather that we are becoming too many. Either way, we've arrived at the point where we've begun to clog up one of the main pipes feeding us new people. In my view, Congress will eventually need to grow. Maybe next year, maybe the year after, but soon. Now, this meets with very thoughtful opposition from people I respect and take very seriously, slowly morphing this event into its next size up, say 5 or 6,000 people, is challenging, and if things go wrong, it could very well kill this event altogether. The negative example often used around me is DEF CON, an event I have not yet visited. But I've done some research. DEF CON 6, held 12 years ago in 1998, had about half as many attendees as are now in this building. And according to what I can find online, it already suffered from the same problems associated with DEF CON today. In full force, no real sense of community, way too much influence from the corporate and military universes, a sense of us versus them, misbehaving goons, one giant drunken frat party. I guess what I'm saying is that maybe there are some issues inherent to DEF CON that don't seem to bother this event to quite the same degree. But it's not just group culture that will be an issue. We've seemingly reached the limits of what a purely volunteer organization can do. Growing Congress is going to be challenging and dangerous. So I'm not saying we shouldn't be very careful. If we do decide to grow it, it'll take all the talent we have to keep the many aspects of this event that we all like and that we all need in one piece. At best, this event is going to be in mortal danger for a few years. But not growing has risks and dangers too. No matter how brilliantly we set up the distribution of tickets, when the hours to click a ticket become minutes, most of the potential new blood, and many of us, will be locked out. There are other solutions to the same problem, which I'm definitely not discounting. We could make more congresses, either simultaneously or not. I just haven't missed a congress since 1988, and I guess I would personally be quite sad if we couldn't all be together in one place, at least once a year. But whatever we decide, the next few years will test our ability to listen to each other, to come up with ideas, and to work together to make them happen. In closing off, anthropologist Margaret Mead once famously said, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." Now, that's all nice and well, but this gathering and this community, I think, have proven that there's still a sizable niche for really large groups of committed citizens. I wish you all an excellent Congress.
An dieser Stelle müsste ich jetzt eigentlich so tun, als hätte ich das gerade angehört. Habe ich nicht. Dafür gibt es jetzt Musik. Und zwar mal ganz was anderes. Nämlich das Kraftfutter-Mischwerk hat mal ein Album rausgelassen über Weihnachten. Nämlich am Ende der Kirschallee unter CC BY SA Lizenz. Und da kriegt ihr einfach den ersten Titel von auf die Ohren. Der heißt nämlich Stay Pretty, ist 5 Minuten 43 lang. Und dann muss ich mir da keine großen Gedanken machen, was ich da denn so an Musik euch verpasse. Und dann sage ich einfach mal wieder danke fürs Anhören, runterladen, streamen oder was auch immer ihr sonst noch so gemacht habt, um mich hier hören zu können. Vernehmen klingt ja wieder so nach Polizei. Und bis zum nächsten Mal, wenn da nichts dazwischen kommt. Und viel Spaß mit der Musik. Thank you.
He's a great guy. He's got a saying, and I don't know if it's his original saying or not, but it's like 98% of all lenses are better than 100% of all photographers. So
it ain't the lens, in other words, it's the photographer.
Yeah, when somebody was looking at my Alaska pictures of the grizzly bear and said, "Man, you must have a really good camera." I said, "Yeah, I got it the same place Shakespeare bought that pen."